Now, TalkZone presents Money at Work, the weekly show that addresses the issues of the day from a financial perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to another edition of Money at Work. We're coming to you from the Alexandria office of OB Capital Management. And we come through you, to you through TalkZone.com as well. OV Capital, I will remind you, is a registered investment advisory in the state of Virginia. It's headquartered here in Virginia, and as such, we are subject to all the rules and regulations applying to all registered investment advisories in the Commonwealth. And today, we're going to be taking a look at economic factors that are affecting the economy right now and the markets. Economic factors typically always affect the economy. That's why they're called economic factors. I just realized that. But they'll be affecting the markets. And Steve's going to stop by in a bit to kind of tease that for us. Lily's going to be with us also today. She's going to take us into the final week before taxes are due and kind of get you ready for any curveballs that might be coming along. There may be some things in the offing that you might not expect because earnings have to be redeclared and declared again and depending on what's going on. And Lily doesn't want you to freak on your investment advisor when some of these things happen. So before we get going, before I bring Steve in here, let's just take a quick look at the indices. And again, it's today. I mean, I don't know if you've been paying attention, but it's another bloodbath on Wall Street. The Dow's down about 182 to 16,254. NASDAQ is off 105 to 4,078. The S&P is down 27. It's at 1844, but the S&P is still holding pretty well there for the year. And Steve, I'm going to bring you in here now to kind of tease some of the things that you're going to be talking about today. We're going to start getting into things like the Fed notes and deflationary issues. And at the end, you're going to tell us about three dogs that you want to take out and shoot that you're going to recommend to everybody, or as we like to say around here, that we're going to consciously uncouple from. So why don't you give us kind of a heads up on what you're going to talk to us about today and you know, how it pertains to the overall economy and markets.
Well, thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Yes, actually, I think it'd be a little more difficult to find economic indicators that don't affect the economy. But anyway, we're really going to focus on a couple of things here today. One is, with the Fed notes that were released from March, particularly when we had Janet Yellen coming out and saying, we got into this discussion actually too on one of the programs about when, in fact, we'd start to go ahead and see interest rates improve or increase is the better word to use. When we're taking a look at unemployment, the idea that we were moving from a single indicator on unemployment out to a range of indicators. Well, what the Fed has done, they've come out and they've released their notes. They release their notes always. It's usually about a month lag. But it gives us a little more insight into exactly what was going on, what the Fed was thinking at the time. That gives us a little bit of a better idea about what we can expect from the Fed in the future and really what they see as affecting the economy, what their concerns are, what direction things are moving. And so we get a little bit of a interpretation from some of the Fed folks as to how this quote-unquote recovery is going along. And then we can add that to the knowledge that we have and what we see out there in the marketplace. And this is how we go ahead and make our estimates of individual sectors, economic growth, what we think is going to be a reasonable expectation for the market for the year. And really, one of the things that we've seen this year is there really hasn't, as we talked about at the beginning of the year, is not much as far as event-driven news. And so what we're left with is good old-fashioned stock picking as the ability to go ahead and make returns in the marketplace. So with that, what we need to do is not just find the best stocks to own. In the last couple of weeks, we've taken a look at those particular positions that have either been good dividending positions, that was our topic of conversation, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, last week when we took a look at some of the defensive positions that were worth owning. What we're going to take a look at today are those stocks that we feel, if you currently have them in your portfolio, Well, if you haven't gotten rid of them by now, we feel that these guys are good opportunities, either because they're fully valued, because the economic conditions dictate, or just the management of the company has dictated that these guys are better off elsewhere.
And this is something – stock will not commit suicide for you.
Exactly.
It's like it's like you want someone to break up with you and they just won't do it. You're right. Going to have to be the one that pulls the trigger on this because they're not going away unless you do something about
it. Yeah, well, that's it. The stock will go ahead and commit suicide. It'll just take you with it. That's the problem. You know, so the idea is there needs to be a point in time where you sit there and you stare your stock in the face and you say, you know what, we've had a good run. Or even if it wasn't a good run, we feel at this point in time your talents are better suited elsewhere.
It's not me, it's you.
Exactly. So, yeah, and the reason is, like I say, whether it's valuation, whether it's management of the company or whatever. So we're going to give you three of our some of our best ideas of stocks not to own at this point.
Or not to own them. If you already own them, that ship has sailed. So which ones to kind of just hold your nose and get rid of?
Yeah. Now, in full disclosure, we have owned one of these stocks at one point in time. Actually, I think we owned two of them, but it's been a while since we owned one.
And we sold them because we're so clever.
Well, we did sell. Yes, exactly. And the third is a stock that we haven't owned for quite some time. So none of these stocks are in portfolios at OV Capital. None of them have been at OV Capital for a while. We are not shorting positions. We don't do that here at OV. We'll leave that up to those of you who want to take that kind of risk. And if you choose to go ahead and take a short risk, make sure you consult that with your financial advisor. Make sure that any decision you make on a stock is appropriate for your risk and your long-term goals. We don't recommend making a short decision based upon what we say here without knowledge of your portfolio.
That would be short-sighted.
Ill-advised. Exactly.
So you're going to get into those a little bit later in the program for us then?
We'll pick that up on the other half after Lily comes in and regales us with it. I noticed you brought out the tax word.
I did. The tax word always makes Lily's eyes light up. She perks right up when we start talking taxes.
Usually sends me into a cold sweat, but
this is like, this has been like for Lily. This has been like the playoffs leading up to the big, to the big game. And the big game is, of course, next Tuesday, the 15th. So Lil, you and I were talking earlier this morning. We were having coffee and kind of discussing the program today, and you brought up a really interesting point, some things that people might not be thinking of, as earnings get restated and things like that. They want to get their taxes done, but they can't always do that in the time frame that they want to, can they?
No. Hi, Brian and Steve.
Afternoon, Lil.
Thank you for having me again.
And you bet. Well, you're a regular.
Oh, thank you. Yes, when you talk about income tax, it really does make my eyes light up because, after all, I am a volunteer certified income tax preparer for Fairfax County.
That's great. So you're so shrewd, you actually do this free.
I do it for free because I just truly enjoy it. Anyway.
All right. Okay.
It's funny that you talk about the 1099 because a lot of the investors, they receive the 1099 in February or March, kind of like give them an idea what distribution of interest dividend they have received from their investment account, as well as capital gain and losses, money they've made from selling or money they have lost from selling. So, and a lot of time is a good idea not to use the first one because most likely you're going to receive another one, which is a revised copy of the 1099. And the reason why they do that is because a lot of time if you have like a real estate investment trust or master limited partnership in your portfolio, a lot of the investment firm quite often recharacterize those earnings. Instead of declaring as a dividend or interest, they might say that it is a return of capital. So, and that's the reason why you should really wait before you turn all your stuff over to your CPA, because you don't want them to charge you again from looking at the same thing.
Well, that's only if you don't have somebody doing it for free, right, Lily?
Yes, but I think most of the people, you know, have it done by a certified public accountant, unless, you know, you smart enough to go and get a TurboTax and do it yourself.
Or have a volunteer come and do it for you.
Right, yeah. If you need help, yeah, just call Steve, and Steve will call me, and I'll be happy to do it for you.
Okay, now last week, Lily, you were talking to us about, you know, making preparations for your final IRA contributions and you know, what the limits were and all of that. I was just wondering if you'd just briefly go over that again, what the contribution limits are for 50 and under, 50 and over, and, you know, how it relates to Roths and traditional IRAs. Let's hit that one more time, just in case folks weren't listening last week and they have, and that's been on their mind.
Okay. Now, I think everybody knows that you can do $5,500 for both a Roth or a traditional IRA account. But if you're 15 over.
But not for each, right? I mean,
right,
it's got to be a combination.
Well, actually, you know, like if someone who's in the borderline, you know, they can contribute some money to Roth and some money to a traditional IRA account, but just
right,
be
but
sure
not,
the whole.
It's not $5,500 to each one.
No, no. It's the total contribution is $5,500. If you're 50 and over, then you get that additional catch up.
Okay. So that's for if you're below 50.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, below 50 is 55.
Okay, so, and then over 50 is
6,000
even?
$6,500.
$6,500. Okay, good.
Right. And while I'm at it, I might as well inform people that if you are doing a traditional IRA contribution that are non-deductible, be sure to file a Form 8606.
And
what is
8606? What's that?
Now, 8606 is for people who put money into an IRA account, but they cannot deduct it.
Okay.
So, when you contribute to your IRA account, the tax year that you file your tax return, you should attach an 8606, putting the entire amount that is non-deductible along, you know, with when you file your tax return. And the reason is because that amount is already been taxed. So when you put it in your tax deferred account, at some point you're going to take the money out, and that portion that is non-deductible is your basis. And you shouldn't have to be taxed again, because at that time it is going to be ordinary income when you take distribution. Now, a Roth, of course, you know, is non-taxable when you take it out. So you don't have to worry about it if you have a Roth IRA account. I'm just saying that if you have a non-deductible IRA account because you make too much money, which is a good thing, just be sure to file the 8606.
Okay, so and as we come up on as we come up on the break, and we also come up on the 15th of April, you can make contributions up till April 15th for 2013, full contributions if you haven't already,
yes.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you could also then make your contribution for 2014. So theoretically, a person under the age of 50 could put in $11,000, and a person over the age of 50 could put in $13,000.
Exactly.
And yes. just cover both tax
can
years.
Can cover both, yeah. And it's actually
excellent.
A good idea to do it ahead of time instead of waiting until the end of the year, because you're losing out on
the
tax deferred growth, the compounded growth.
Okay, well, we're coming up on our first break of the day.
I just had a quick question, just a quick yes or no before we head to break. Lily, if you file an extension, do you then have until October to make your contribution into your IRA?
Let me think about that.
Is that something we should come back to after the break, maybe?
Mull that one over, and when we come back from the break, we'll get that question answered for you. You're listening to Money at Work through TalkZone.com, coming to you from OV Capital Management.
Welcome back to Money at Work on Talk Zone. Here's Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. And just a reminder that if you want to get a message to the program here, you can do so by emailing us at mail@ovcapital.net. That's mail@ovcapital.net. And before we went to the break, you know, I was previewed Lily by talking about, you know, some of the curveballs that she might be able to help you see. And then right before the break, Steve threw one at her, a nice 12-6 curveball that caught the bottom part of the strike zone. And Steve, why don't you reiterate your question to Lily, and then Lily can go ahead and try and knock it out of the park.
Okay, yeah. Sorry about throwing this in the middle, right before a break. That's always a horrible thing to do.
But well, I like that because it really keeps me on my toes. I'm about to go to break. I have just one more question.
Anyway, I was just kind of curious as to how contributions to an IRA are done when you have an extension. So if you go ahead and given the date coming up here on the 15th of April, and we have an automatic extension that's available to us if we ask for it, that takes us into October essentially. The question is, do the contributions for an IRA made for the past year have to be done by April 15th, or if for some reason you didn't have the money or didn't have the inclination or just completely forgot about it, could you make that contribution in October at the time of your extension?
Sure. Let's make sure that form is 4868, application of automatic extension of time to file U.S. individual tax return. And at first I thought, well, April 15 was the filing date, but if you have to file an extension, would that change? And when I thought about it, it should change because the contribution is based on your income, right? If it is a
right.
deductible, non-deductible, Roth IRA. So yes, the answer is yes, you have, you know, the extended date is going to be the deadline for you to make the contribution for the prior year's contribution.
Okay, so since it's based upon income and therefore based upon when you file your taxes and declare your income, that your contribution into your IRA, because it's a deduction you're taking, right? And since it's a deduction, you're deducting it from your taxes, so that contribution can be made at the time you file, as opposed to a deadline of a particular day. So like a 401k, for example, 401k, your contributions are done by December 31st. You know, you're not making any 401k contributions for a prior year. You just can't because it's a systematic investment. It's a setup and it has an administration and all that kind of stuff. But with an IRA, since it's a contribution that's generally made to achieve a tax deduction, and that tax deduction is associated with the filing of your taxes, therefore, you can make that contribution as late as your final extension then, right?
Exactly. And
yeah, okay.
Don't forget, like the Roth IRA account, you know, you say, well, gee, if you're not done with your tax return, you really have no idea what your modified adjusted income is in
right.
order to make the determination if you qualify for a Roth or not, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So excellent. Procrastinators of the world. Well, we'll get
yes,
back to you on
don't
that.
Don't worry. Yeah. Just file a form 4868 and take your time. But one thing you should remember, if you think you're going to owe money, you should send in a check along with your 4868. Because just because you have an extension doesn't mean that, you know, you don't have to pay if you owe money. So
that's
you
right.
don't want
that's,
to pay late filing fees or penalty.
Right. The IRS wants its money, and they don't care if you know how much that is. They want it anyway.
Operative word, it's. They really do think it's theirs. So, yeah, don't get caught with your own hand in your own cookie jar. Lily, thanks. I want you to stick around and invite you to just throw a monkey wrench into whatever Steve's saying anytime you want the rest of the program to kind of throw him that same curveball back. But right now, we're going to focus on something, as I so eloquently put it at the start, economic factors that affect the economy. And, Steve, we were talking about this is really interesting stuff because when we were talking earlier, you know, we got all the way back into, you know, inflationary pressures and stagflation in the Carter years. I don't want to take your copy from you, but those were parts of the discussion that I found really interesting. And as we kind of flesh things out, I thought those would be the real interesting points to kind of compare yesterday and today and give people an idea that, you know, we hear the word inflation, it's like a buzzword, you know, like it's always bad. So I wanted you to kind of pick up the ball here and give us your own take on what's going on in the economy from an economic standpoint.
Okay. If the economy from an economic standpoint, well, let me get back, I think, a bit.
Dibs on that for a book title, by the way.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and just kind of use the Fed as a bit of an intro here into what's going on. Because we did get there, we got the Fed notes, and yesterday's rally essentially came out on the heels of what the Fed was saying. And much of what everybody took away from that was there was some concern about the levels of inflation. And this concern led them to readjust, if you will, their views on where the economy is headed. And that in turn led them to maybe want to take a bit of a more transparent stance on the raising of interest rates. As you know, one of the things that we had seen coming out of the Fed meeting was an expectation that interest rate increases could be as soon as a year away, in 2015, because we're figuring the winding down of quantitative easing to end sometime in the fall. And then the expectation from Janet Yellen's comments saying that we could see an increase in short-term lending rates as recently or as quickly as 6 months following the completion of that wind down, which would put it about a year away. And, you know, look, years go by quickly, and the older I get, the more I notice that the years go by quickly. So the market responded to that and had a bit of a sell-off, and then we kind of reevaluated what she was saying, and maybe it wasn't quite as bad, and the markets moved back up again. Yesterday, the dissection of these notes had the Fed, we were taking a look at the Fed brain, if you will, and while they eventually kind of adopted this whole wait-and-see approach, one of the things that they had been discussing was the possibility of making an explicit commitment, keeping short-term interest rates down at this artificially low level, this pin near zero level, and that would have been the kind of thing that went ahead and really kind of goosed the market back in March. They adopted the wait and see. There was a little confusion. Janet Yellen made some comments. So when we had yesterday come about after this, after the release of these notes, everybody felt a kind of an ease, and we saw some significant gains. Today we've kind of given a lot of that back. When one of the things you got to realize that the Fed is going ahead and kind of dissecting the economy and saying, hey, look, our inflation targets are substantially lower than what they should be. If we go ahead and we compare where the target forecast was for 2015, back in April of 2013, we were looking at about a 1.9% forecast. Now, our current forecast is around 1.6%. In the advanced economies. When you're looking at overall world economies, I guess we're looking at about 3.4 versus 3.7%. All of this and the chart, actually, if you take a look at it, I can't show you the chart because this is radio. But if I could show you the chart, you'd be looking at it. And since people like to go ahead and take these straight line approaches, it can be a little ominous to take a look at this really kind of negative trend here. And that's one of the things. And there's actually some call coming out now from some really more conservative areas that deflation is quite possibly on the horizon. Matter of fact, when you take a look at what happened over in Sweden, and you know I pay attention to that. But in Sweden, the consumer prices dropped about 0.6% in March. That's the most since 2009, November of 2009, actually. It's twice as much as they expected. And really what they've got is the Riksbank governor came out and made a pledge that we would end up taking substantial measures to avoid deflation.
Quickly, is there a quick way for you to kind of contrast, juxtapose, if you will, inflation and deflation?
Well, certainly. Deflation is more than just decreasing interest rates. Deflation is an actual fall in prices, where inflation is an increase in prices. Okay, so what we talk about when we have disinflation, we see the inflation rates getting lower. So if we're talking about a 1.6% inflation rate versus a 1.9% inflation rate, that's disinflation. Okay, it's just the rate of inflation is decreasing. Deflation is an actual circumstance where prices are declining. And you think that sounds like a great thing, but really it can wreak havoc on an economy. And much of this, I think we're going to have to go ahead and hold over. We'll talk about it a bit more in the impact of deflation on the bank. But the fact is that what we're seeing out of the Fed notes is that they haven't said deflation, but in Europe and now in the U.S., one of the things that is concerning people is this low level of inflation and the potential, the possibility of deflation. And policies that we take in government, policies that the Fed takes will have significant impact on whether or not we go ahead and we head into a deflationary environment. Back in 2008, 2009, Brian, you and I were talking about this oftentimes. You know, this was one of those concerns that we had. Is there a possibility for deflation? Are we seeing a deflationary environment? Given that the Fed was cutting interest rates like the barber of Seville cut heads, okay?
Yeah. Gatling gun style.
Exactly. You know, that was there a situation that, we knew that there wasn't a problem necessarily with the amount of cash floating around in the economy. The question was, what is the fundamental problem? The fundamental problem is, are we in a deflationary environment? Nobody really kind of wanted to say the word deflation because on the lips of folks, that has a real, real bad effect. It's like going ahead and yelling fire in a theater.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into the rest of this, well, more of it, because it's really a great subject. On the other side of the break, we're coming up on the bottom of the hour. We've already done half the program already. So I want to remind you that you're listening to Money at Work through TalkZone.com, coming to you live from OB Capital Management.
And now, more of Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Here's Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Thank you. Welcome back. This is Brian Bourdon. I'm with Steve Memory and Lily Poy, Certified Financial Planner at OV Capital Management. And we've been talking about deflationary pressures and how that affects the markets and the economies. We were doing that before we went to break. We kind of came up on the break, and Steve, you were right in the middle of a thought, and I didn't want you to, you know, get interrupted by the break. So why don't you just go ahead and pick it up and take it and run with it from where you were.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Well, we were talking about deflation and inflation as kind of two different things. To get into inflation a little bit, when people hear inflation, we've kind of been conditioned to think of inflation as the dirty word, you know? And, oh my gosh, there's inflation out there. But the fact is that without inflation, we really don't have an engine driving the economy. As I've mentioned often, it's a little like going ahead and having a lobster fest. You got this giant pot of water, and inflation is the fire that you have under it. When we have stagnant economy or a non-robust recovery, is whatever you want to, euphemism you want to use. It's a little like trying to go ahead and boil this giant pot of water with a Bic lighter. Okay.
It doesn't sound festive at all.
No, exactly. And you certainly don't want to eat your lobster raw, believe me. So, but on the other hand, when you have a big roaring fire, you need to control that inflation. Okay, you can't have just this raging bonfire of an economy and try to cook your lobster on top of it. It won't work.
I like what you were talking about stagflation earlier, where they thought it was, you know, economists thought it was impossible to have a stagnant economy but high inflation.
Exactly.
And you likened it to, you're in the kitchen, the drapes are on fire, your apron's on fire, but the stove won't light.
Exactly.
So you can't cook anything.
Right. Yeah. Before Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s, it under, you know, Keynesian economics, it was thought that if you have inflation, you have growth. The two are hand in hand. You can't have growth without inflation, and you can't have inflation without growth. Well, we found out, yes, you can have inflation without growth. The kitchen was on fire, but nothing got cooked.
And those four famous words were yet again evoked. This time it's different.
Of course, exactly. It's always different. But, okay, so that's inflation. The idea is that some inflation is needed for an economy. If you're going to go ahead and you're going to have an economy moving forward, if you're going to have growth, some inflation is good. We need to have that. Okay, so, and that's the reverse side of what happens with deflation. Okay. In a deflationary cycle, prices are actually falling. So why does this go ahead and make economies just go nuts? What kind of shudders at when they hear it? Well, the problem with deflation is that we enter into this death spiral in an economy. Okay. Because we have a circumstance that we're expecting prices to be lower in the future. And if prices are going to be lower, why in the world do you spend your money now? You don't. People hold on to money. And the net result is that when people go ahead and don't spend money, it amplifies that deflationary cycle. Okay? People hold on to their money. They're not spending things. Earnings are not showing up in the businesses, the drivers and the engines of economy. And so these businesses then have to hold on to their cash. They don't expend resources in to revamp or buy new manufacturing materials. Producer prices, et cetera, start falling. And what you find is that people start laying additional people off. So we start seeing an increase in unemployment. We start seeing a reduction in overall spending. We see economies tend to go ahead and start this circle, circling down the drain there, and it becomes a very difficult environment to go ahead and get yourself out of. One of the other things that you have after you've got people that are going ahead and holding onto their money, they're not buying things, and so they're not driving economies, and then you have companies that are not going ahead buying things. Inflation adjustment. Okay, when you take a look at the interest rate, the inflation-adjusted interest rate declines because – or actually raises, and so your overall spending falls. And then the third problem is that while all this is happening, you know, your wages tend to be pretty sticky. So, I mean, you can't come in and slash wages, and what they do is they just start laying people off. If people are being laid off, they don't see that as a possibility, and additionally, prices are going to be lower in the future. This is the kind of thing that really drives companies and countries necessarily into the ground.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I remember a modern example of a deflation. Let's remember Japan's economy.
Right, absolutely.
And they were caught in a deflationary spiral for the last 20 years.
Still have had difficulty going ahead and getting their economy to come out of it. Yeah.
Right. And this deflation started in 1989 when the Bank of Japan raised interest rate, causing the asset bubble in housing to burst. And during that decade, the economy was growing really slowly. I think it was like less than 2% per year. And businesses cut back on debt. You know, debt is not always bad if you can service it. And spending and loss of productivity with a lot of workers, you know, in the Japanese culture, they don't like to lay off people. So, and then also the Japanese people, they are savers. So if they see a sign of recession, they're going to stop spending and then put away, you know, their money for bad times. So.
Right.
God, what a novel idea. That's brilliant.
But yeah, well, here's part of the thing, though, is that the advantage of a capitalistic system is the free flow of capital. Okay. The ability to borrow and spend and invest is what allows engines, the engine of the economy to grow. It is the fundamental basis of capitalism. Okay. The reason that we've seen, the kind of growth, significant growth in the United States that we saw, following the development of capitalism, prior to which was really there was only the feudal system in place, what we've seen as a result of the influx of capitalism is the a rising of a standard of living across the world. Okay, you don't get that. You get the reverse in a deflationary environment. The problem that Japan had, one of the big problems it had, was a lot of the corporations that were out there had large piles of cash. They had war chests of cash that they were sitting on. And this money was not either being returned to the owners of Japanese stock, okay, in the form of dividends or dividend payments, return of capital. And it was also not being used to foment R&D, research and development. There was no additional acquisition. It was just a stagnant situation. And this is part of what comes about in a deflationary environment, okay?
Are there any circumstances under which deflation is beneficial?
The problem with deflation is that it doesn't happen for a short amount of time, okay? In other words, deflation doesn't date you. Deflation marries you, okay?
It stays. Half your stuff.
It moves in. It's there, exactly, okay? So you don't really usually get a little bit of deflation. So when you see countries like Sweden here committing to avoiding deflation, there's a reason for that, okay? You don't want a deflationary environment. It just it wreaks havoc on the entire system, okay? So obviously, if you're going to go ahead and find that your money is worth more just by sitting on it in a mattress, you know, why invest? Why hire? Why spend money to move your business forward? Why spend money to move an economy forward? The problem is that particularly with countries like Sweden, which has a high level of social service, okay, they have a certain amount of safety net that they are responsible for, okay? They are committed to going ahead and providing these services. If the economy moves into a deflationary environment there, they're not going to get the revenue to be able to provide these services. And that is from a government's perspective, that's a side of things that you really don't want to go ahead and mess with.
You know, irony abounds, because if we went out on the street right now here in Alexandria, just went up to the square and talked to 10 people and say, what do you fear most, an inflationary economy or a deflationary economy? I guarantee nine out of 10 would say, oh, inflationary economy is just, you know, bad.
Well, sure, yeah. You know, but that's all we've ever seen. I mean, really. I mean, well, with the exception, maybe you could make the case for 2008, 2009, but we really didn't see fundamental those prices, that CPE, we didn't hit a decline. We still hit that declining inflation rate. Okay, so we have, yes, extremely low inflation. And we fortunately haven't found that circumstance where we've hit a negative inflation. But you want to go ahead and see why countries like the United States come out and hit that quantitative easing, okay, is because really it's the only weapon we have against a deflationary environment. It may not be particularly effective. Okay, like we were stating back in 2009, when you're cutting interest rates, banks have tons of cash. You can go ahead and lend money if you had people to lend it to. But the criteria for lending is so high and so stringent, coming after the debacles of the lending of the 2000s, when we had these environments where you know, you could lend to anyone and his brother so long as they could sign their name or someone else's name. It didn't matter. You could get an interest-only loan at whatever interest rates, and, you know, things were moving along. You take all that away. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to require everybody to have 50% of the money up front. They've got to have a co-signer. And, you know, if your parents aren't willing to do it because they're dead, then, you know, you're out of luck. These are, you know, the changes, the swing, the pendulum moves pretty far to another to the other side. And that kind of has the ability to spark things. But it's not a function of, hey, there's not enough cash floating around in the economy. We know that. We've seen it. I mean, there's been that was the fundamental argument of the asset bubble about stocks improving, that, hey, this is so much cash and it has to go someplace and it's going into the stock market. Well, look, earnings were still being driven and we didn't see a bubble, but the possibility of deflation being out there is something that at least we need to go ahead and ward off against. And that's why we need to go ahead and really kind of revisit this idea about, well, what are we going to do on the quantitative easing side? It's a necessary evil. Why? Because it's the only weapon we really have against deflation at this point. You know, there's no real way of going ahead and forcing things. You can't just artificially raise the minimum wage and say that's going to go ahead and cause inflation.
It's tough when you get down to that last arrow in the quiver, you know, and you're kind of waiting for the right time to shoot it because you know you just got the one.
Exactly.
You know, when you're talking about the quantitative easing, and this is, I mean, that's why it's been such a kind of a seesaw back and forth with that thing, as to when's the best time, how much should it be tapered, when should it be eliminated altogether. You know, it's almost like, well, once we do this, it's done. You can't get the toothpaste back in the tube.
Yeah. Well, it also means you got to be very aware of what kind of things are we implementing as part of policy. Look, the reason that one of the reasons, as I mentioned, that the Swedes are concerned, they have a big social net. We're now moving in that direction, you know, at the worst possible time, if in fact we see deflation on the horizon.
We're going to pick up more on this on the other side of the break. We're coming up to our final 15-minute segment of the day. You're listening to Money at Work through TalkZone.com, coming to you from OV Capital Management in Alexandria, Virginia.
You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Back to Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Cue the air guitar. That's what I have from Dave at TalkZone. Steve likes to play the air guitar going into the last break here because of that bumper music, and I don't try to stop him. It's just very enjoyable to watch. This is our final segment of the day. This is the quickest hour of the week. I mean, we always sit here and think, well, what do we want to talk about on the show today? You know, how much material do we need? And we always end up with way too much. And Steve, I'm going to have you put the cap on what we were talking about on the deflationary side of things and how, you know, is that a real prospect or not? And then you're going to get into those three dogs that you want to take out and shoot. And we're going to close out the program with them. So take it away, buddy.
Okay, no problem. Look, as we were talking about, deflation is the boogeyman that lurks in the closet. It's the monster under the bed. It's the thing that's out there. And for the most part, we usually don't have to address it, okay? But every now and then, we find ourselves in a circumstance where the lights have gone out, the door's closed, and our parents have left us home alone. And those are the times when we have to wonder, hey, is that just my stuffed clown, or is that really deflation lurking out of the closet?
Steve actually has the palms against his cheeks right now.
Fortunately, we're not in a circumstance where deflation is upon us. But it is something to go ahead and watch, and it's something that we have to keep aware of, and it's something that from an investment standpoint we want to go ahead and be ahead of the curve on, because it will require a significant readjustment to a portfolio.
Don't be afraid to do a little bit more saving, a little bit more investing than spending maybe in the next several months, kind of getting ready to see what happens.
Well, look, we've gone through at this point in time. We took a look at good dividending positions, which are always nice to have in a stagnant or a flat environment, because total return, always a very important part of your investment portfolio. Anytime we can include dividends, defensive stocks we talked about. The question is when do we go ahead and when do we have the a stock that we need to sell? Under what circumstances are we looking to do that? And really what we look for is primarily what's its valuation. If we have a stock that we have owned, we have had a price target on it based upon valuation. And that's the number one way that we go ahead and make a determination that we need to sell. Secondarily, we also can sell for reasons of allocation. If for some reason we see a situation where we need to reallocate a portfolio and move away, we will sell positions, but that's not a reason to sell all. Typically, we go ahead and we start off by selling about a third of a position once it's appreciated. And that dovetails into our third reason for selling, which is profit taking. If we have a stock that's run up and it's gone and it's moved significantly, we will oftentimes go ahead and take a portion of that stock and move it off the table, because we want to go ahead and we want to put that cash in our back pocket. So those primarily are the reasons that we sell. But then what do we look for? We're looking for the valuation of a stock. We're looking for the environment that surrounds it. What are the regulatory environment? What is the economic environment? And these things impact whether or not this is a position that we want to own, we want to go ahead and sell. Another thing we look for is management of a stock. How are they managing the growth of the company? How are they managing the debt of the company? With that in mind, we now have our top three. These are the top three positions that you want to consciously uncouple from at this point in time. I'm going to start off the first one here with a stock that we actually owned at one point in time. We sold this a while back. It is not in any OV Capital portfolio. But all of these stocks, these generally aren't obvious. Okay. There's good reasons to want to own these stocks. And so that's part of the reason we picked these as things that, you know, this isn't the company that's necessarily on the verge of bankruptcy, but this is a company that you want to go ahead and take your profit if you've owned it at a reasonable level, or you want to go ahead and just get it out of there because there are some things out there. The first one, Cliffs Natural Resources, CLF is the ticker symbol. This is currently trading right around the $20 a share range. The yield on it is 2.94%. So you say, hey, look, that sounds really nice, Steve. Why in the world do I want to go ahead and get rid of this? Well, look, Cliffs, this is not Cliffs Notes by any means. It's Cliffs Natural Resources. They're engaging in the production of iron ore pellets, fines lump ore, metallurgical coal. They operate in four segments of the economy, U.S. iron ore, Eastern Canadian ore, Northern American ore, Asian Pacific. Okay. In 2013, U.S. counted for 13% of revenues. China, 33% of the revenues. China accounted for 34% of the revenue. So we're looking here. It's all about China. Okay. We had a drop of 3.1% in revenues in 2013. We're looking for a 12% decline in 2014. Asia is pretty well supplied, with iron ore. We expect moderate demand growth. There's essentially an overcapacity in ore. Our target price based upon its PE, look, the PE is at a discount, okay, but the forward earnings were at a premium, and that's what we're talking about here. The current price in the 20s, we're looking for about $16 on it, so it's well fully valued, and at this point in time, one of those things that we're looking to go ahead and get out. You particularly want to go ahead and take a look at the sales growth. Sales growth is fairly pretty much negative right now. So that's number three. Number two, symbol is BTU. This is Peabody Energy Corp. Current price on that is in the 17.5 range. Okay. They're trading about 40% of the overbought side. They have a dividend of about 1.93%. Again, you say, Steve, that sounds pretty good, right? But you take a look at their Q4 per share adjusted per share operating, and they had a loss of $1.12 versus 84 cents. They missed the 14 cent earning per share forecast, and this is largely due to higher operating costs. Okay, negative earnings. When you've got negative earnings, it's tough to go ahead and actually take a look at PEG ratios or PE ratios with any kind of reliability because there's nothing really there. Okay, but when we have a debt to equity ratio of 1.54, that's quite high, substantially higher than the industry average. They have a quick ratio of 0.57, which says, look, they got some difficulties going ahead and managing short term debt. Their net profit margin is negative 32.45%. Okay, that's substantially lower than average. They took operating cash down to $178 million, which is and been down. They have a cash flow growth rate of negative 23%. All of these things together say, look, this is not a situation that we want to go ahead and be in. BTU, by the way, mid-cap stock trader in the New York Stock Exchange, not owned by OV Capital. Number one, Mack-Cali Real Estate Trust, symbol on this is CLI. Trust price currently about 21.5 in that range. The yield, because it's a real estate investment trust, 5.65%. Small cap value stock traded on the New York Stock Exchange. They are a real estate investment trust. They've been focused primarily on the acquisition development of office properties. Their earnings come out on April 24th, and that's going to be a big day for them. Over the last 3 months, they're up about 1.77%. And given that and their yield, understandable to want to go ahead and say, hey, maybe this is a place we want to be open. But look, they're planning asset sales. So we expect that the 2014 revenues should be down about 6.7%. Roughly about $640 million. That we have a substantial number of lease expirations that are coming up. 11.3% of their annual base rents are coming up. There's a low occupancy and pressure on rental rates. They're currently constructing about 2,630 apartment complexes, moving into the multifamily situation. But these are also going to come under pressure because of the increase in new home construction, meaning there's a lot more competition and increased pricing pressure. They cut their dividend by 33% back in July of 13. They're at a premium on price to earnings. They're on a premium at peg ratio. Their sales growth is significantly lower, about 1.61 versus their peers of 20.84. Our price target on this stock is about 18. Okay, so we're looking at full valuation from our particular perspective. If you have it in your portfolio, we suggest you go ahead and kindly ask it to leave.
Now, are there indications of what insiders are doing with these companies? I mean, is that kind of a telltale sign for you?
Well, you go ahead and take a look at the CFO, I believe, of Matt Calley, has gone ahead and has been divesting himself of about 30% of his position over the past year or so, maybe 6, 9, 12 months.
Okay, so that, you know, he knows something that you don't, and you might want to know.
He's the CFO. What does he know?
And don't consider that inside information, because it's obviously public information. It's public information on what insiders are doing, which is perfectly legal for you to follow. You can usually find that on the value line. Yes, well, that's going to be it for this week. I want to thank Lily Poy for joining us, our CFP. Steve, as always, we'll stick around and do our post-mortem when this is through, but I want to thank you once again for joining us. You've been listening to Money at Work through TalkZone.com, coming to you live from OB Capital Management. Have a great week.